All right, guess what, people? This is the end of Genesis. This is the last week about Genesis. You made it. Congratulations. Because you made it, you earned yourself a joke from someone unnamed. who will remain unnamed. How did Adam and Eve feel when they left the Garden of Eden? They felt put out. Boom, boom. You've got to have a good dad joke to finish Genesis, right? Okay. So I'm going to go out on a bit of a limb here and tell you what I hope will come of this morning, all right, before I've even started. I'm going to do an itsy-bitsy recap of Genesis. Then we're going to take some very big and very hard-to-explain truths and hopefully translate them into some bite-sized pieces of encouragement. And then my prayer is that these little bite-sized pieces of encouragement will give us all the stamina to endure the circumstances that we find ourselves in today. So let's go back to September 21st, 2025, when we started this whole journey. And this was our big idea for the day. The Creator God of the Bible is sovereign and good. He, in His sovereignty and goodness, He brings peace and light. So we started off in September and we read God employing His immense power and wisdom to create the world in which He intends to work out His purposes. He assured us that He is more than capable to fulfill these purposes. He declared, "I am God and there is no other." And we learned that not only is God purposeful and powerful and a creator, He is good. Okay, so then we moved on and we found out that human beings were made in His image and invited to live with God and to rule over His creation, and God offered us shalom. So this concept of peace and wholeness and completeness and flourishing with Him, a right relationship with Him, a right relationship with each other, and a right relationship with all of creation. This is the way that He intended it from the beginning when He created the universe. So Genesis 1. God created man in His own image. In the image of God, He created them. Male and female, He created them. And God blessed them, and God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth." And then if we flip all the way to the end of Revelation where we have been before, we can see that His purposes extend from the beginning of eternity all to the way to the end, and we read verses like Revelation 21, "Behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be His people, and God Himself will be with them as their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore, for the former things have passed away." So between these two beautiful pictures, we have the creation picture and then the new creation at the end of time, we discovered and we live in a world that has been devastated by sin and suffering and death. And Genesis had a lot of that, right? We had a lot of stories of that. So the big idea for the book of Genesis is this. There is a good creator whose good creation, and that's us, just in case you missed that, repeatedly makes bad decisions, significantly damaging the rest of creation. The good creator does not give up on His creation, us, and continually offers recreation. This is the entire biblical story, right? And it's a repeating pattern, and we saw it over and over, especially in the beginning of Genesis. And as we found out, as we went through Genesis, we see this thread that leads us towards Jesus. Jesus, who was present at creation and then stepped into creation and is God's plan to bring us back to shalom. So we ended last week, all the way 50 chapters later, with Tom doing an amazing summary of the story of Joseph. And that was a crazy story, right? It was full of lots of stuff that you could not call peace and light. He had a dysfunctional family. He was beaten. He was thrown in a pit by his brothers. He was sold into slavery. He was accused of a crime. He spent years in a Egyptian prison. And now we get to the final verses of chapter 50. It's very cinematic. Jacob has just passed away, his father. They've done what they need to do to bury him. And he's standing there with a message from his brothers, and he's crying because despite everything that he's done for them, they are lying to him again. And it feels very, very far from God's Eden starting point, right? And we have these words from Joseph, chapter 50, verse 20. He's talking to his brothers. "You intended to harm me, but God intended for good to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives." Now, there's a lot to talk about in this little verse, but I'm going to start with what we're going to call the pivot, all right? Now, commentaries, I wish I had one of those really good movie voices, you know, that do the movie trailers, because this is what, like, the commentaries say about the pivot. "The phrase hits like a sudden wall, a dramatic divine reversal, a major narrative turning point, the grammatical slam. It's a single, hard-hitting compound word that drops into the narrative to stop human failure in its tracks." And it's talking about "but God," right there in the middle of that sentence. So this is a pattern that we see in Genesis. These "but God" moments establish this direction where human agency gets to its end and fails and does a really bad job, and God flips the script on the human condition and sends out divine rescue. This divine sovereignty in accomplishing the redemption of the world. The story that goes all the way to Revelation. So let's remind ourselves what God's sovereignty is. This is a quote from N.T. Wright. "Sovereignty refers to God's absolute power, supreme authority, and right to rule over all things. There is nothing that happens outside of his sovereign will. The Son of God, through whom God created the world, sustains the universe by the mighty power of his command. We need to perceive God's sovereignty through the lens of the cross. God does not rule with an iron fist like a great army general. He rules like a sacrificial lamb. We should view God's providence, and that's how his sovereignty works out, not as controlling like a puppet master, but as God working through faithful human stewardship, the power of the cross to bring new creation. The power of the cross speaks to God closing the distance and entering human suffering to bring healing." So I'm going to get a little Bible nerdy on you right now, okay? But this was just too cool to leave not said. All right, so here is the Hebrew for "but God," all right? I'm not going to try and say it. I think it's like Ved Elohim. Elohim? I don't know. Who speaks Hebrew here? Is it in the grammatical sense of it, the "but" is called the contrast, right? It says the contrast and the divine name of God are fused together. So that little symbol at the beginning that has a straight line, that straight line is actually the word for "but," but it sticks onto the name of God at the front in the way that the Hebrew is written. And it makes us immediately go to God and not humanity. It fuses the divine action directly to the pivot, all right? So you've got this combination, it's one word. So if you are a Hebrew reader, and we've said often in Genesis to try and read this in the context or come to it as people who were thinking, they would have gone reading, they would have seen that and gone, whoa, right? It was definitely a pivot point, the way that it was written. And this is, I'm going to give you some examples in Genesis of "but God" verses where this would have come. So in Genesis 7, it's talking about the end of Genesis 7, the earth, how wicked it was, where how everybody had disappointed God. He was so sad, and he decided to send the flood. And it says, "All were destroyed, and the flood waters covered the earth for 150 days. But God remembered Noah and the ark and the people," and it said, "and the waters receded." I love this picture of "but God," because it's like 150 days is a long time to sit on an ark wondering what God's doing, right? But God remembered Noah. He knew, he saw, he was working while that was going on. In Genesis 20, Abraham, you might remember, came to King Abimelech, and he deceived him or lied about who Sarah was, so that he said he was his sister, she was his sister, so that, you know, trying to protect whatever was going on. And Abimelech took her as his wife. And then, now this is a Philistine king, no relationship with God. And the verse says, "Abraham lied to King Abimelech about who his wife Sarah was, and the king took Sarah his wife. But God came to Abimelech in a dream one night, and they had a full-on conversation about how you are not to take Sarah as your wife, and if you do, things will happen." Only God, the second part of "but God" statements, is really only things God can do, right, to talk to someone in a dream. And then Genesis 31 is the conversation between Laban and Jacob. And it says, Jacob says to Laban, "You would surely have sent me away empty-handed. The end of a human attempt by both of them," actually. They were both pretty deceiving and lying and wanting the best for themselves and not the other. "But God has seen my hardship and the toil of my hands, and last night he rebuked you." And again, we'll talk about this in a minute, but God's character comes out in these "but you" statements. Now, I don't want you to think that the people in the New Testament were left out of this whole exciting grammar thing that was going on. In the Greek, when we have when we have "but God," it actually reads "the but God." And what happens is, it's like a suspense moment. So you have the God, which is our God, the only God. The is there to make sure people don't confuse him with any other gods that are going on. We have the God, but because "but" is not allowed in Greek to go at the front, it gets put in the middle, and so you end up with "the but God," which I just think is a great, great way to remember. He is the but God. He does the but things. He does the pivot. He does the changes. He is the but God. And it brings the suspense and the tension. I know, it's a funny, it's a big but with one T. Okay, so in Acts 7, it says, "Because the patriarchs were jealous of Joseph, they sold him as a slave into Egypt. The but God was with him." I love that. This is a pattern that goes all the way through the Psalms, New Testament, Old Testament. We see this. Well, what did Tom say? Well, humans are busy humaning or being human. What did you say? Humans do humaning. Humans gonna human. Well, humans are gonna human. God is being God and doing only what God can do. So in your hands, you have a God list, but God list from all the sermons that we've done. And the placing of that "but" in the middle makes it sort of fused to the character, inseparable from the character of God, being put between the name of God there, the God. And as you look at this list, this is the character traits of God that the "but" God is talking about. And I don't know if you remember the stories that go with each of these, but it's a great list to have at home and to go back through Genesis and remind yourself of all the ways that we learnt and God revealed himself during this series. So if we go back to verse 20 and we've done the pivot, right? Joseph says very clearly to his brothers, "You meant it for harm, but God," he's going to do something here and he's going to pivot. The second part of the verse is, God intended it for good to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. So we get this concept that God has been working this whole time, right? This meanwhile, while humans were doing what they were doing, God was working. And if we back up a few chapters to Genesis 45, we have this moment where Joseph is talking to his brothers again, and he captures how God overrides human malice and hardship and executes a rescue plan. So this is Genesis 45. "For 2 years now, there has been famine in the land, and for the next 5 years, there will be no ploughing and reaping. But God sent me ahead of you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance." So Joseph looks back at the pit he was thrown in, the chains that he was put in, the false accusations, the years in prison, and he doesn't see these random, terrible tragedies. He sees divine positioning. He sees God moving him into the right place. So what is that all about? Like, how do we explain that? What do we mean when we say, like, God's working behind the scenes, he's in control, he's moving all these pieces for good? I was watching this section I've watched a lot of it, but this section particularly on the Bible Project, Dr. Tim Mackey. He is a very, very smart man. He has studied Hebrew. He knows a lot more than I do. He got to this verse, and I'm like, yes, I am going to find out the answer to that question about what is going on here. And he says, who knows? He says, how will we ever really know how human agency and divine agency work? How do we know if God is sovereign? How is human agency preserved as well? And he gave a very quick, and I'm going to repeat it, very quick three kind of ways people have thought about this and buckets. He said, I've read lots of books by very smart people. I've swung between all these. You can go and do the same. But at the end, he's come to the same place, which is who knows. But there's the Calvinist way of thinking where it's very heavy on the sovereignty. We're sort of playing out a script that God has written. People feel like they have agency, but it's kind of based on what has been revealed to them. So it's sort of that's that one. There's a ship theory, which is we are all on a ship. We know where the ship is going. The destination has been determined, but the journey is going to feel a little different, pleasant or unpleasant, depending on what decisions you make along the way and the journey. But what happens on the journey isn't predetermined, but where we're going is. And then the last one is kind of like God is along for the ride. He is the most brilliant chess player who is going to win the game, but he's working out the moves along the way as people make decisions and we're heading towards the end of the game. So there's three things for you to read up about and consider. But Dr. Mackey finishes by saying, there is one thing I have confidence in. No matter what, the God's divine purpose will work itself out and is working itself out, and there's nothing that we can do to thwart it. So there are some things I know. I don't know the answer to that whole big thing, and I want to finish by just sharing some things that I think I've learnt along the way, especially this last year, of living in a very big but God moment, and I think hopefully this might be encouraging to you where you are. So I think we're all really familiar with out of Eden circumstances, right, where we are finding it really hard to understand what's going on. It might be caused by other people. It might be caused by decisions we've made. And maybe it's just because of life, right? Life is happening and we all have pain and heartbreak happening around us. And I think what commonly happens is our hope just dries up. And we get disconnected from God, from people, and we wonder what God is doing and where he is. And I was reading Lisa Turkhurst on this, and I've never related more to this, what I'm going to read you. She says, we start thinking about all the good a good God can surely do. And while we're thinking about all the good that a good God could surely do for us, we start to attach our hope to the good things that we think make up a good plan, and then we start telling God, here's the good plan, good God, of the good things that a good God could do. And then we say, please bless my plan. And then we hold him accountable to that plan. Anyone else relate to that? Right. And when we do this, and the plan doesn't happen, we are in danger of like believing that God is not good because he didn't hold up his end of the bargain. And we do this even though Scripture tells us our thoughts and our ways are not God's thoughts and our ways, and we're told that sometimes our plans are not best for us. In Proverbs, it says, in their hearts, humans plan their course, but the Lord establishes their steps. Another thing I know, and this is a hard one, and I have wrestled with this a lot this year, is sometimes we need a change of perspective. Paul, who had the craziest list of circumstances, life circumstances happen to him, wrote this in 2 Corinthians. That is why we never give up. Though our bodies are dying, our spirits are being renewed every day. For our present troubles are small and won't last very long. Yet they produce for us a glory that vastly outweighs them and will last forever. So we don't look back at the troubles we can see now. Rather, we fix our gaze on things that cannot be seen. For the things we see now will soon be gone, but the things we cannot see will last forever. That's really hard when you're in circumstances that go on for a long time, right? But it's true, because eternity, the end of our story has already been written. Jesus has written our story in blood and in the resurrection, and eternity can help us hold in a space in our brokenness that sustains us to get us to the end. Here's some more encouraging positive things that I know. God is the initiator of the rescue. He's the initiator of the pivot. We don't get to start the plan, okay? He starts the plan. And another quote from N.T. Wright, redemption doesn't mean scrapping what's there and starting again from a clean slate, but rather liberating what has come to be enslaved. When God starts a plan, frees us, he did it by forgiving us first, right? He made the first move. While we're in sin, he forgave us. And that frees us to get out of this cycle of failure and to be transformed, to be like him so that we can live for him regardless of our circumstances. I got a text yesterday. Tammy said I could share this with you. She works in an office, a dentist office. A patient came in and she said, while the patient was checking in, she said she just kept hearing the Holy Spirit say, you need to pray for her, you need to pray for her, she needs you to pray for her. And she was like, okay. And so the lady went in, came out. Now, Tammy, I've worked with Tammy for a long time now, and she loves God. She's wanting to be transformed, to be like him. She's also got life happening as well, right? But she watches the lady leave the office, and she follows her out to the parking lot, and she says, I don't know if this is okay, but I really feel like I should pray for you. And the lady just starts crying and says, I have been praying for something from God to, like, you know, show me that he's there. I've been having a really hard time. And Tammy was able to pray for her. Now, that plan was set in motion by God, separate to both these people that were involved. But Tammy, because she is chasing after God and listening to the Holy Spirit, and this other lady in her hard times is leaning into God, he was able to bring the two together. And I just think that is our encouragement, right? Is while we feel like God's not doing anything, we can still be being transformed. We can still be doing something because he is working as it's going on. The next thing is we can't earn his favor enough to change our circumstances. So yes, we need to lean in, but it's in relationship. It's not in a list of to-dos. It's not a list of have-to-dos, because we are rescued by God's grace alone. And the enemy would like to tell us otherwise, right? He would like us to know that God needs more from you. God will only do this when you do this, or this will only happen when, you know, these things line up. But God takes separate, wildly different things, sometimes painful things, and he steps in and overrides the enemy's doubts and things that he's planting in you and his intentions, because he wants to build our faith and he wants to deepen our empathy and he wants us to see his glory and see him work. While we're waiting and trusting for God, the pivot is only possible if we rest our hope in that list, in God, in who he is, in what he will do, because he is faithful to his character, he is faithful to his love, he is faithful to his sovereignty, and he will remain who he is forever. And then just to finish, we need to remember that we are, and Tom talked about this in this series, that we're living in the already but not yet. And so while things are hard and while God is working, we can still experience joy and laughter and love and peace, and we can see things moving and we can see prayers answered, and all the while we're still waiting for that final moment, right, that I read earlier, where there's no more pain and no more crying while we're waiting in this broken world. I'd be very remiss if I didn't say the last gift that God gave us with this thing of trying to understand how he's working when we can't see him working is he's given us this community. And that is how we wait, and that's how we trust, and that's how our faith gets strong, is we share stories like Tammy shared. You know, we share the fact that we're stuck and we don't know when the pivot is coming, and we don't know if God is pivoting for us, and we lean into other people's faith to remind us of the but God, right? That's who we have as our Saviour. That's who set this whole thing in motion back in creation. So we're going to have communion together this morning, and I'm going to simply just read two chunks of verses. They're on your sheet there, that are but God verses that bring us to this acknowledgement that we are at the end of what we can do as people, and God is the one that saves us. So